Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. A few weeks ago, Scott Jones was aimlessly scrolling around on Facebook.
Passing the COVID loneliness days one day, like the great time drain suck of the universe. And something popped up about applying to be a corona vaccine trial participant. And I filled out the information, which was not super extensive. I mean, it took a few minutes. And I really forgot about it, that I had done it.
But then he got a phone call. Do you remember filling out this information? And are you still interested?
I said, sure.
And so in October, he went to a research office at the University of Pennsylvania to participate in phase 3 of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine trial.
Sitting there, filling out forms and getting blood drawn and that sort of stuff and getting injected.
So what was it like to get the injection? Were you nervous?
You know, I wasn't that nervous because I'm unattached. Like, I'm not partnered. I don't have any dependents. And so I really thought about this and I thought, look, no family's abandoned if something goes wrong, or right? Or I'm not like 78 and if something goes wrong, it could be a death sentence. So I figured my odds were pretty good.
And any side effects?
I haven't. And, you know, I'm pretty impressed, though, about the protocols and stuff and the mechanisms. Like, they had me download this app. It messages me every day and says, okay, take your temperature. Or do you have any symptoms? Do you have fever? Do you have achiness? Is there achiness in the spot? But no, I haven't had any adverse side effects at all.
After he got the shot, Scott had a drink at a bar outside, and he started talking to a couple at another table, 6 feet apart, of course.
And they were strangers. And I told them I had done this. And they were really... I felt like they had such a sense of solidarity and were so encouraging. You know, being in kind of the COVID context where, you know, everybody's isolating so much, like, I hadn't felt so much solidarity in a while. I felt like, wow, we're fighting the virus together. We're in this together, you know, which was a really nice feeling.
As a physician working in public health, Chris Purnell found out very early on that the hospital where she works in Newark, New Jersey, would be a partner site for a COVID vaccine trial.
And I immediately asked myself, you know, silently, would you do this? And it was a resounding yes for me. It was a resounding yes.
There were several reasons for that resounding yes. Chris focuses on health equity, and she's seen the devastation of the pandemic, especially in the Black community. Volunteering for the trial seemed like a way to lead by example. But for her, the decision went far beyond that.
My dad would frequently say to me, follow the data, follow the science. And as a public health physician, I believe in public health science. And I know how important it is in solutioning around this pandemic, which has been so destructive. It has been so destructive for Black and brown communities, and it has been destructive in my family personally. I lost my dad, and not only did I lose my father, but my older sister, who's a breast cancer survivor, is what we call a long hauler. She's going through a very long recovery from coronavirus. So this was personal for me. It's a part of me living out my father's legacy, is a part of me helping to, you know, be in covenant with community, and is a part of me adding to the public health science, adding to the data to help us find a solution.
A vaccine promises a way out of the pandemic, a way to end the suffering and dying, the isolation and distance. But finding one that works is only the first step in a long process. On today's episode, the quest for a vaccine. Why some say we're moving too fast, while others argue that we're not going nearly fast enough. Also, the challenges involved in distribution and getting people to trust the process. The trial Chris and Scott are participating in is double blind, so neither they nor the people administering the shot know whether what's in the syringe is the actual vaccine or a placebo. And this vaccine is also utilizing a brand new approach, something called messenger RNA. Here's Scott again.
I was hoping I would get superpowers, like, you know, like I would, you know, become like the next Spider-Man or something. But to date, I have no superpowers yet.
No superpowers and no way of knowing if he has any protection against the virus. So for now, that means taking all of the usual precautions to stay safe, isolating, masking up, and so on. But think about it. Some people in this trial may be getting actual protection from the virus, while others are getting salt water. That aspect of vaccine development has always troubled pediatrician and vaccine researcher Paul Offit. He told me about a man who died during a COVID-19 vaccine trial in Brazil.
And the question was, did he get vaccine or placebo? And everybody breathed a sigh of relief when we realized that he got placebo.
So it wasn't the vaccine that caused his death, but...
But he died of COVID-19. I mean, if he had been in the vaccine group, in all likelihood, he wouldn't have died. So but for the flip of a coin, he died. And that's the tension here. In order to prove that a vaccine works, you know, at some level, people have to suffer or be hospitalized or die. And that's always been the thing that's most upsetting for me.
Paul often thinks about the huge polio vaccine trial in the 1950s, led by virologist Thomas Francis. The trial included several hundred thousand children, some getting the actual vaccine, others being injected with a placebo.
When Thomas Francis got up at the University of Michigan and announced the vaccine was, quote, safe, potent, and effective, those three words were the headline on every newspaper in this country. But how did we prove it was effective?
It was proven effective because 15 children who were in this study died. None of them had received the actual vaccine. And the vast majority of kids who ended up being paralyzed also had not received the vaccine.
I mean, these were first and second graders in the 1950s. These people would otherwise be my age now. I was a first and second grader in the 1950s. I mean, it's hard to look at that and know that, but again, for the flip of a coin, they were either committed to die or be permanently paralyzed. And so that's the horror at some level of these phase three trials, especially when you think you have something that works. You just want to put it out there.
This is just one of the challenges along the way. This one comes at a later stage, but before you even get there, you have a whole bunch of other hurdles to clear. Vaccine development moves in phases and usually starts with an animal model.
Where in this case, you would inoculate the animals with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, whether it's a mouse or rat, and then hope for the purposes of your studies that the animal develops the same symptoms that a human develops. Then you can try out your vaccine, whatever strategy that is. You inoculate the animal with your vaccine, and then you challenge them with this virus and see whether or not the animal's protected.
Next up would be a phase one trial in humans, maybe 20 to 100 participants, where you test if the vaccine induces an immune response, and you figure out the exact dose that's needed.
Then you go to phase two studies, which involves usually several hundred people, to make sure that the vaccine is consistently inducing the immune response that you think is protective and at least doesn't cause a common serious side effect problem.
Okay, so let's say all of that has worked out so far. Then we enter phase three.
Right, and that involves tens of thousands of people who either given the vaccine or not given the vaccine, and then they are just sent out into the world, and then you'll see what happens. I mean, in order for you to tell whether or not the vaccine worked, a critical number of people need to be come sick in the placebo group. So let's say 150 people in your placebo group become ill with this COVID-19, and only 5 in the vaccine become ill, then you can say with some degree of certainty that the vaccine appears to be effective. And once you've tested it in tens of thousands of people, you can say at least it doesn't have a relatively uncommon severe side effect problem.
In terms of Operation Warp Speed, which parts of the phases you have just laid out for us, does it speed up, and where are we operating at the same speed?
I think that warp speed has made it so that, for the most part, phase two is skipped. You've gone pretty much from phase one, these dose-ranging studies, where you now know the dose and how many doses you want to give, and go right to really large phase three trials. And in addition, what Warp Speed has done is basically they've taken the risk out of it for pharmaceutical companies. They've said, look, we'll pay for the phase three trials, which costs hundreds of millions of dollars. We'll pay for the mass production, even not knowing whether or not the vaccine is safe, not knowing whether the vaccine is effective. We'll take the risk for that. We'll make hundreds of millions of doses not knowing whether this vaccine works and is safe. And if it doesn't work and if it isn't safe, then we'll just throw those millions of doses away. No pharmaceutical company would ever do that. So I think for the purpose of the public's understanding of what is being skipped or shortened, because I think anybody reasonably, just frankly with the phrase warp speed, would worry that things are being done too quickly, that timelines are compressed unfairly, that safety guidelines are being skipped. As long as you do a phase three study, a big prospective placebo-controlled study, then you are holding this pretty much the same standard that you would any vaccine.
Paul says vaccine development is heavily regulated. It's a carefully designed process because there's so much at stake. He likes to quote Maurice Hilleman, who developed many of our modern vaccines.
He said it best, quote, "I never breathe a sigh of relief until the first 3 million doses are out there." And that's always true.
Paul says he felt that pressure when the rotavirus vaccine he helped to develop hit the market.
Oh my God, this is now going to be given to hundreds of millions of people. So, you go through all this sort of gene data banks trying to think, is there anything that this vaccine could do that would be harmful? And you're always worrying that you have done that. You've created something that actually did more harm than good.
Over the years, there have been issues with different vaccines. It's rare, but there have been instances where people became ill or even died as a result. And that is... it's terrible, but if we look at the history of vaccines and if we think about the deaths they have prevented, the illnesses they have prevented, that far, 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 far outweighs the damage, correct?
I think that's exactly correct. The sad truth is if you look back through any medical breakthrough, take your pick, anesthesia, antibiotics, transplantation, any of them, there is always at some level a human price to pay for knowledge, sad as it is. You'd like to think there was a better way to do this, but you learn as you go.
That's pediatrician and vaccine researcher Paul Offit. We're talking about the quest to find a coronavirus vaccine. There's always a balance of risk and benefit that you have to take into account. Careful steps that are supposed to safeguard against things going wrong. But some scientists are questioning whether that is the right approach for the situation we're in at the moment. A global pandemic claiming thousands of lives every day. Jad Slaman has this story of one researcher who is challenging the status quo.
In late March, when the U.S. was still talking about coronavirus lockdown in terms of weeks instead of months, when people were wiping down their groceries with disinfectant spray and basically scared to step outside, biologist Preston Estep sat alone in his lab, ready to try a coronavirus vaccine, a vaccine that he had developed in just a few weeks.
I took a small dose, and I usually do this with pharmaceutical therapeutics. I always take a small dose first, just in case, there's some sort of negative reaction.
Preston took maybe a tenth of the total dose, waited a few hours, and then took the rest.
It just felt really good, really positive about taking that first step of taking that first shot of vaccine. And when I say shot, I mean, nasal, a spritz up the nose. So, it was less dramatic than sticking a needle in oneself.
So what drove Preston here, sniffing his own homemade vaccine? It was the way people were dying. Preston was devastated by the thought of people dying alone.
Is it basically older people were being quarantined away from their families and they were being left to die alone in sealed rooms, hundreds and then thousands of them. And I couldn't stand the idea that we were going to wait a year and a half while these sorts of scenarios played out.
Preston is a geneticist by training, not an immunologist, but he's Harvard-trained and highly connected in scientific circles.
I had studied with some of the smartest and most capable and amazing scientists in the world. I've been up close and personal to some, you know, radical breakthroughs and important scientific work that's happened very quickly.
The way he explained it to me is it's not so much that he was convinced he could do something about the coronavirus. More, he just wasn't convinced that he'd be totally useless. He assembled the Rapid Development Vaccine Collaborative, RADVAC, essentially a posse of scientists that he'd known from previous work. Preston found it wasn't all that hard to get the band back together. Scientists, like many of the rest of us, had their careers upended by March of 2020. A lot of them were out of work, or at least cut off from whatever they were researching at the time, thanks to coronavirus restrictions. One of his collaborators even had a lab space.
We had a fully stocked professional biotech lab, basically ready to go.
And they were off. Something I was surprised to learn from Preston, and as I looked into vaccine development in general, is it's not all that hard to create one from a technical standpoint. It's not of the same engineering order as, say, making some kind of nuclear reactor. Preston found there was already decades-old technology that had been tested in humans that he could use to deliver the vaccine in a nasal spray.
You can form gel nanoparticles that are about the size of a virus and that cross the mucous membrane because of both the size and the chemical properties. And it acts as an ideal intranasal vaccine delivery vehicle.
There's basically five ingredients to form those particles, and they're all readily available. To get the immune response, Preston's team used little bits of artificially synthesized protein that mimic bits of the coronavirus.
It basically all came together very quickly. Within a week or two, I had a basic design.
So if creating a vaccine is the easy part, it's testing it that gets tricky, figuring out if it's safe and effective before distributing it to literally every living human being on the planet. The only ethical test subject, he figured, was himself. Since taking that first dose in March, Preston and his collaborators have developed 8 more versions of the vaccine and tried them all.
We volunteered ourselves as the designers of the vaccine. We decided that the only way, you know, to create that rapid feedback loop of design iterations and testing was to use it on ourselves.
Design, test, look for the immune response, improve, design, test, improve. It's a nimble, small-scale operation outside of the rigid, months-long phases big pharma companies operate under. What the world calls warp speed, the way pharmaceutical giants and governments are working together to create a vaccine in 18 months rather than the usual span of several years, to Preston is slow motion. His group wants any scientist or anyone with access to a lab and enough know-how to be able to mix up their vaccine to have their recipe. All their research is open source and free.
So for a commercial vaccine that is going to reach population scales, there are multiple steps that are important to take, some of which are probably more designed for a non-pandemic situation. Each one of those steps slows down the process incrementally.
There's two things Preston thinks the rest of the scientific establishment is missing in the COVID moment. One is the idea that desperate times call for desperate measures.
The Hippocratic Oath, you know, or you know, other similar kinds of ideologies. You know, first do no harm. But when we're talking about public health scale measures, do no harm is not an option. In doing nothing is doing harm.
And the second idea is that his desperate measures aren't actually all that desperate.
I think that people are not weighing the appropriate risks. They're overweighting the risks of the vaccines. They're underweighting the risks of the virus. I don't think that, you know, the vaccines that have the least of the safety features that, you know, might cross the finish line, you know, into commercial availability, I can't even imagine that they would cause even, you know, 1/10 of the harm that the virus is causing.
The way he sees it, there's this hyper-focus on vaccine safety slowing the rollout that ignores the real devastation that the virus is doing right now, every single day that passes without a vaccine.
Have you ever heard of a vaccine that has caused 1,000 people a day to die? And, you know, this is what's happening in the U.S. today. 1,000 people a day are dying. I can't even imagine, you know, a vaccine coming from any of the top pharma that would cause that kind of harm. You know, there's this acceptance of the harm that the virus is doing because we can't, you know, we don't have the power to just turn it off.
No one company or government is solely or essentially responsible for the virus. It comes from nature, and many epidemiologists say a pandemic of this kind was more of a when, not an if. A vaccine, though, is different. Someone, some organization, company, government has to create it and make the decision to distribute it. And if it hurts people, it becomes really easy to cast really specific blame. In short, it's risky. And Preston says the problem is we humans are really bad at understanding risk.
I think this is really one of the most memorable psychological experiments, you know, in all of our histories. You know, we are living through a time where people are failing, you know, governments are failing, every organization is failing an experiment on risk balancing.
I gotta admit, after my conversation with Preston, I thought about the virus and our response to it differently. It's easy to forget that the world is going through something that it's never been through before. We're all living through an experiment, and even the experts are amateurs in a way. In the meantime, Preston says his group still doesn't know how robust the immune protection is that you get from their vaccine or how long it lasts, which that's actually going to be a challenge for the mainstream vaccine producers as well. So these days, even after 8 doses of coronavirus vaccine, Preston still wears a mask, still practices social distance. Anything less just wouldn't be worth the risk. For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
So we just heard about Preston Estep. He's a biologist who's been working on a vaccine since March. He's been testing it on himself. And I wanted to ask vaccine researcher Paul Offit what his take was on that.
Yes, I think we do need to get a vaccine out as quickly as possible. That said, we need to make sure that the vaccine works and that it's safe, at least that it works in X thousands of people, and that it's safe in X thousands of people for a certain period of time. You have to show that. Because if you put a vaccine out there that is ineffective, you will lose or shake what is already kind of a fragile vaccine confidence in the United States. Or worse, if you put something out there that has a serious side effect problem, again, you will shake vaccine confidence and make it much more difficult to get that second vaccine or third vaccine out there. And we need vaccines. So you can't lose the trust of the American public.
Yeah. And I have to admit, you know, when I was listening to Preston talk, there was a part of me that thought, yeah, I would try that thing he made. I would totally try that right now. It is attractive to think, man, we could just get this thing out there and see if it works. But I guess going rogue has consequences.
Yes. You want to, I mean, it's very appealing. It's that sort of, you know, Lorenzo's oil appeal, the sort of citizen science that we can just take it, be the individual initiative. You know, we have this thing in America, you know, that sort of cowboyism where, gosh darn it, we're just going to build that old barn and put on a show. You need to prove it. There are so many examples in the vaccine world where you need to prove that it works. I mean, there was a respiratory syncytial virus vaccine that was made in the 1960s that came out of the Laboratory of Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. Animal models look good, initial data look good, and you know, then when they put it into phase 3 trial, they found that the children who got that vaccine were more likely to develop pneumonia, more likely to be hospitalized, and in the case of 2 children, more likely to die than children who didn't get that vaccine. And you know, the history of frankly, medical breakthroughs is littered with those kinds of stories. So you need to have a proof. You definitely need to have a proof before you move forward. The question is, how much of a proof do you need?
Paul Offit is the director of the Vaccine Education Center and an infectious disease physician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. It's hard to avoid the elephant in the room when it comes to vaccination, and that's trust. public health experts and vaccine researchers have had to fight hard for the public's trust for decades, combating false claims that vaccines cause autism and all kinds of other health issues. With this coronavirus vaccine, that trust is once again at stake. A bad outcome, a serious side effect could really shake up faith in the process. When we asked people about their hopes and fears for the vaccine, trust kept coming up.
The COVID-19 vaccine has me very skeptical. I think it's being developed way too quickly, and that doesn't give me a lot of confidence in how safe it's going to be to actually get it.
I wouldn't know what the long-term side effects will be, which concerns me a lot. I think it's way too soon. There are so many questions out there, like what happens if the virus mutates? Will we still have immunity after you take the vaccine?
My fear is the pandemic, COVID. And the thing about the vaccine is I hope that it works.
I think when I can get the vaccine, I will get it, but I am afraid of it. Like, I'm afraid that I'll have a bad reaction to it and that, like, something bad will happen to me.
I would love to see a vaccine. So I would say that if Dr. Fauci, for example, approves the vaccine, and if we have scientists who back this claim up, then I'd be fine with it.
Once the vaccine comes out and is announced, what I'll be paying attention to is what scientists say, what the data shows, what, you know, trusted media sources are saying. And based on that, I'll decide if it looks safe. And if everything looks good, then I'll trust it.
Thank you for all of those comments. The best way to be in touch with us is on Facebook or Twitter at WHYY The Pulse. When it comes to trust in vaccines, there's often another factor at play: history. For many communities in the U.S., vaccines and vaccine trials bring to mind an ugly and painful history of unethical research and experimentation that was led or sanctioned by the U.S. government. The Navajo Nation, which lies in Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico, is the largest Indian reservation in the U.S. They've been hit hard by the virus, which has also had a very high death rate there. Still, people say they have a difficult time trusting a vaccine. Reporter Anthony Wallace has more.
The last time I visited the Navajo Nation, I was in Pinyon, Arizona, a four-hour drive from where I live in Phoenix. It was a Thursday morning, but nobody was rushing to school or work. As the orange and purple sunrise illuminated distant mountains and gave way to daylight in the expansive desert, the only noise came from birds. The unusual quiet is a result of COVID-19 mitigation measures. In the early months of the pandemic, the reservation had a higher infection rate than any U.S. state, and its president, Jonathan Nez, enacted strict lockdowns to stop the spread. Since then, schools have been empty of students, they've had nightly curfews, and on the weekends, all businesses, including grocery stores and gas stations, are closed. People driving there risk getting citations at police checkpoints. The reservation goes dark and quiet. But in mid-September, there is a frenzy of virtual activity happening on Facebook. President Nez made an announcement. The Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine trial was coming to the Navajo Nation, and they were looking for volunteers.
The first thing I thought was just no, you know, why is this happening?
That's Roxanne Sosi. She and others were not happy to hear Navajos would be a part of the trials. The comment section under the announcement lit up with concerns from the Navajo people. She and many other commenters had a similar sentiment. Do not trust the government. We are not guinea pigs.
Hearing about it just runs through the whole quick history in your head. It just kind of makes me sick, you know?
And the news of the trials came at a really tough time. The reservation is a small community, and the virus hit it so hard. Everybody I talk to knows somebody who's gotten sick or passed away. Roxanne lost 4 family members to the virus and one of her close friends, who was just 46.
When I lost my friend, you know, get choked up. But that was the one that hit me the hardest because, you know, she left behind her kids, and it was tough.
In a way, the vaccine trial points to progress and an end to the pandemic. But for Roxanne and so many others, it triggers painful memories.
I mean, it's just massive amounts of history that's been swept under the rug and under the table.
In her mind, this history goes back to the moment Christopher Columbus arrived in the Americas. These first Europeans brought deadly smallpox, influenza, and measles with them, and tens of millions of indigenous people died within decades. Settlers waged war on native populations and uprooted them from their homes through brutal, forced migrations. And again, they've been harmed under the guise of receiving care. From blankets infected with smallpox in the 1700s, to the forced sterilization of thousands of Native women in the 1970s, the Native American population has taken hit after hit, and their numbers have dwindled.
I just feel like we're basically the invisible race in the United States, you know, Indians across the board.
Roxanne and so many others who descend from those who survived just don't trust the Western world and the U.S. government when it comes to health and medicine.
I will say that one of my favorite sayings is that progress happens at the speed of trust. The best time to have established trust was 10 years ago, 20 years ago. The second best time is today.
This is Shmuel Shoham. He's an infectious disease expert with Johns Hopkins and helps oversee coronavirus trials happening in the Navajo Nation. He's working on a plasma trial funded by the U.S. Department of Defense, and it's raised similar skepticism as the vaccine trials. He says it's critical to include different populations in the trials, and he's excited to have the Navajo people on board.
So it's important to, when looking at data, to have it reflective of the people that actually have the disease itself.
He says volunteers are coming out for the trials, and he hopes enrollment picks up as they progress. But he understands the hesitancy in the history.
We had enough. We had enough as Diné people. We had enough.
This is Travis Teller. He's a researcher at Diné College. Diné means the people in the Navajo language, and it's usually the word they use to refer to themselves. Travis is a traditional Navajo medicine man. They're spiritual leaders for people on the reservation and safeguards of its ancient culture and language. When the pandemic hit, Navajo people flocked to them for help. Many of the medicine men, Travis says, were exposed to the virus, and several died after contracting it.
We need to think of one another as human existence, human beings, as one, because we're being treated so bad out here on the Navajo reservation.
He says if Johns Hopkins or the Indian Health Services worked harder to collaborate with medicine men like himself, it could improve the mistrust problem on the reservation.
Medicine people are willing to share. It's just that nobody is willing to work with them, or nobody is willing to reach out to them. IHS kind of puts them on the back burner.
Jamie Watchman Johnson lives on the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico. She's had personal experience with controversial medical practices involving Native Americans.
Oh, I'm holding my daughter. Her name is Heshjebot. She's almost 2 months old today.
She's very well-behaved. Very
so far, yeah.
Her daughter's name means spirit of a woman warrior. And this past spring, just before she was born, Loveless Hospital in Albuquerque was secretly testing Native American women for COVID-19. And separating them from their newborn children while waiting for test results. The state of New Mexico is investigating the scandal now. But even knowing this, Jamie went there to deliver her baby.
But I still went there because I figured that they had learned their lesson and they did treat me well and they didn't separate me from my baby.
Despite the history and her own experiences, Jamie remains optimistic. She said she would take the vaccine once it's fully approved. She just hopes her fellow Diné people know what they're getting themselves into when they volunteer for the trials.
You know, it's 2020, and we think that the doctors have learned their lesson, you know, and everybody wants the best interest for everyone, you know.
But Jamie seems to be in the minority. Nobody else I talked to said they were willing to take that leap. They were concerned about the safety of the vaccine and just weren't ready to put all that horrible history behind them.
That was Anthony Wallace reporting. He covers health disparities in the Southwest as a graduate student at Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism in partnership with PBS Arizona. Coming up, once we find a vaccine and are done testing it, a new set of challenges begins.
As we like to say, every component has a patient's name on it.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the quest to develop and distribute a coronavirus vaccine. Right now, scientists across the globe are working together, exchanging ideas and findings that relate to the virus. But when it comes to vaccine development, there's still an element of competition involved, which also ties into global politics. Russia started rolling out its first coronavirus vaccine in August, making it available to essential workers and volunteers. But many Russians are skeptical.
Yeah, I mean, considering that the Russian government has not been very transparent about its efforts.
That's Olga Dobrovidova. She is a senior copywriter at Skoltek, a private research university in Moscow.
We've seen independent journalists being stonewalled, public officials ghosting them, never responding to queries, and limiting access to actual scientists.
She says very little is known about how effective this vaccine is. And research polls have found that 50% of Russians say they won't get vaccinated at all. Olga says given the fact that the vaccine was released with much fanfare and given the name Sputnik V, the whole thing smacks of a PR stunt.
Well, I think that the choice of the name, the Sputnik, which you have to realize that it's just an international name. It has its own local name in Russia, which has nothing to do with Sputnik. This is like the Sputnik is a go-to name in Russia for projects that are supposed to be trailblazing, you know, pioneering in their field. And I think the idea was to present this as the second Sputnik moment in less than a century and just unveil it as a breakthrough in the fight against COVID-19, which actually breaks my heart as a space enthusiast because I feel that there's attempts to use the legacy of the space program to market solutions that are, let's just say, questionable at this point.
But I think the name also says in your face, and it's a name that speaks to a competition, especially with the U.S., that has existed for all these years. I mean, I think especially for a lot of Americans, that name stands for competition, for we got there first, and we beat you.
Yeah, there's certainly a sort of a tough luck moment to this. We got there first, yeah. I'm sure that was one of the intentions to make sure that everyone realizes that this was a race and we won, much like the space race. Interestingly, I don't think that the Russian government is sort of outright presenting this as a win in a race. They have been very careful to say that this is for the benefit of humanity. Putin suggested free vaccines for the UN staff, so they're trying to present it not as a nationalistic kind of win, but as a win for humanity, which of course is quite suspect.
That's Olga Dobrovidova. She is a senior copywriter at Skoltek, a private research university in Moscow. International relations and global politics will play a role in how a vaccine is distributed.
The question about how to distribute vaccines fairly and equitably across all the different countries in the world.
Govind Prasad has been thinking about this question. He is a bioethics scholar at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. For example, if a country like Germany or the U.S. develops a safe and effective vaccine first, the impulse may be to hold on to all of the doses and to vaccinate its own citizens first. But Govind says there is a benefit in sharing.
Everybody is better off for each other person that gets vaccinated. It's more likely for me that I may benefit if my neighbor is vaccinated, it's more likely for me I might benefit. If people are vaccinated in an area that's a hot spot, then an area where they could take other measures to prevent COVID-19 transmission, even without a vaccine.
And then you also have to think about where, globally speaking, the vaccine could do the most good and prevent the most serious irreversible harm.
If you think about a country like, say, Peru, that's dealing with a sort of serious COVID-19 outbreak, that's something where you would view at a country level the urgency of their need for COVID-19 vaccine is being higher than, say, a country like New Zealand, where they've been able to substantially reduce COVID-19 transmission through other public health measures. But the question, say, between New Zealand and Peru is not, does New Zealand get the vaccine or does Peru get it? It's really more, who gets the vaccine earlier on? And so that's why we focus on irreversible harms, because if you get the vaccine later on and you suffered an irreversible harm, it's no good to that country.
Do we have any examples that we can draw on from history where a vaccine was either distributed well or where things did not really work out for a lot of people?
I would actually think about sort of an example in the U.S. more recently, which is not about a vaccine, but about other sort of COVID-19 preventative and curative treatments, which is the way that remdesivir was distributed in the U.S. One of the challenges with the remdesivir distribution was that it wasn't very well organized. There were reports about remdesivir going to places that didn't have a high need for it right then, places that didn't have good capacity to be able to store or administer the drug. And there were other places that were dealing with hotspots where they weren't getting enough. And so I think the lesson from the remdesivir example is sort of threefold for thinking about vaccine allocation globally. One is that I think you have to have a transparent, well-understood, fair process developed in advance, as opposed to sort of be doing things on the fly. The second is, it's important to think not just about, you know, say, give each country an amount of vaccine just proportional to its population. Countries might have similar sized populations, but be very differently placed in terms of the severity of their outbreak. And the last thing is that it's important to think about not only getting the vaccine to the country, but what countries' capacities are with respect to being able to safely store and effectively administer that vaccine. It's important to think about health system capacity as well as just can you get the vaccine there.
That's Govind Prasad from the University of Denver Stern College of Law. He focuses on bioethics and health law. There is another more nuts and bolts aspect to vaccine distribution, getting doses from manufacturing plants to consumers. Experts have estimated as many as 10 billion doses are needed for global coverage, more than any other previous vaccination program has handled at one time. Alan Yu talked to people whose job it is to help solve that logistical challenge.
To deliver billions of doses of a vaccine, you have to think about a lot of small details. David Montecalvo is handling one of them. He's the Chief Operations and Supply Chain Officer of West Pharmaceutical Services, a global company with headquarters in Pennsylvania.
Each year we make billions of stoppers, plungers, and seals that are used with vials, syringes, and cartridges.
David's company has hired an extra 500 people to their team of 8,000 to make sure there are enough of those stoppers for a COVID-19 vaccine.
As we like to say, every component has a patient's name on it.
Once you have enough stoppers and glass vials to hold the vaccine, you still need to get them from a factory to the people who want to be vaccinated. A lot of vaccines need to stay cold. Think about a pint of ice cream that travels from a factory in Vermont to a grocery store freezer in Arizona and has to stay cold the entire time. I recently came across a big white trailer in the loading dock of a Target. It's the kind you would see as part of an 18-wheeler on the highway. It's got a small screen in the front with a digital readout telling you what the internal temperature is at all times.
this is what a trailer refrigerated to negative 8.4 degrees Fahrenheit sounds like.
There's a sticker with the Wi-Fi symbol showing that it's networked, so someone on a computer could check the temperature without having to be next to it. That connected freezer on wheels keeps all that food cold, but the stakes for transporting vaccines are much higher than melted ice cream. Vaccines are sensitive biological products. Some of them are living, so you need to keep those at the right temperatures to keep them alive. Other vaccines are not living, but they work by showing your immune system the shape of a virus or bacteria that could attack you. Your immune system recognizes these tiny things by shape, and their shapes are sensitive to temperatures. That's why some vaccines need to be kept as cold as negative 50 degrees Fahrenheit in a freezer. For reference, that's colder than winter at the coast of Antarctica. One of the COVID-19 vaccines in development is quite unusual and needs to be stored at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. When fridges and freezers fail with vaccines inside, there can be health consequences. This has happened before. For example, in Arizona, in San Mateo, California, at a US Air Force base in Tokyo, where vaccines were damaged because of problems with fridge temperatures. Issues like that can occur during transit or with storage on site at a healthcare facility. Anna Nagurny studies supply chain networks at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
In some cases, the thermostats on the fridges weren't kept within the proper range. Children, infants actually, were vaccinated, but with ineffective vaccines, hundreds of letters had to be written to tell parents, please bring your children back.
The Department of Health and Human Services inspected storage facilities at different U.S. vaccine providers a few years ago. They found that 3/4 of them had some vaccines that were exposed to temperatures outside the recommended range for hours. When that happens, the vaccines could be less effective, and children might have to be vaccinated again. A lot of people are working to make sure this does not happen with vaccines, and especially not the COVID-19 vaccine, whenever we get one that is ready for the general public. The further a vaccine has to travel, the more methods of transportation that are involved, the more challenging things can get. It's like a global high-stakes edition of planes, trains, and automobiles. I talked to Larry Saint-Ange, the president of DHL Life Sciences and Healthcare, a logistics company.
The greatest therapies, the greatest medical devices in the world do no good if they're not in the hands of the doctors or the medical staff to be able to treat the patient.
He says that transporting vaccines means making contingency plans for each airport and each airline, so his team can watch the location and temperature of all the vaccine shipments at all times. And if something goes outside the safe temperature range, they know who to call. DHL and UPS are also building new warehouses full of special freezers. Larry says that in the US, having a fleet of networked refrigerated trailers with constant access to electricity is feasible. But that's less so in other countries, for example, the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Where a backup generator, even in the city, because in some of the capital cities, electricity is not always reliable.
That's Tabani Maposa. He is managing director of country programs at Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. Gavi works with the World Health Organization and UNICEF to bring vaccines to children around the world.
Sometimes some places, a boat has got to be used to get to some places because they can't be accessed by road. And it takes two to three weeks to get to a place just to deliver vaccines and other medical supplies.
He says because of these logistical challenges, Gavi has things like solar refrigerators and drones. They're working on buying thousands more refrigerators, and they're making sure those are from the same brand, because that way you only need to learn how to repair and maintain one model. And because places are hard to get to, they try to plan it out so that they know any vaccines they deliver can get to people who want to be vaccinated in time.
Caregivers may actually come to a health facility and find out that the vaccines have run out and they've got to come another day.
He says they do their best to make sure that does not happen. But he says a country also can't order extra vaccines just to be on the safe side, because you need to pay for the freezers to store them.
If you don't manage your stocks well and you end up over-ordering, your storage capacity can come back to haunt you.
He says there was one country, which he will not name, that ordered too many vaccines and had to store them at the airport, which was expensive. Right now, people around the world are working through these logistical challenges in parallel to vaccine development. The hope is that the timing works out so the distribution chain is ready the day a COVID-19 vaccine is approved.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. Before we go, I had one more big question for vaccine researcher Paul Offit. And when might we see a vaccine here, you and me?
I think that it is very likely that we will see one or more vaccines rolling off the assembly lines into the arms of the American public by early next year. I mean, I'm on the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. We've been asked to hold 3 dates in November and 3 dates in December, presumably to talk about these vaccines when they get submitted for approval through so-called emergency use authorization.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jed Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.